Depending on age and point of view, women have mixed feelings about a female icon who's turning 49 today. Barbie, the doll, had it all. Cool jobs, dream house, clothes, car, longtime companions, and decades of publicity. For this week's profile in NPR's In Character series, Kim Masters explores the life of Barbie and the roles this plastic plaything has filled for girls, feminism, and the American image.
Barbie's small and so petite, her clothes and figure look so neat, purse and hats and gloves galore, and all the gadgets gals adore.
I don't know any other toy that has generated so much discussion and so much passion and so much, usually, ambivalence.
Author Peggy Ornstein has written extensively about issues affecting girls, and she's right. Barbie has been analyzed, politicized, and demonized. She's inspired art and powerful emotions.
You either see her as the embodiment of oppressive Teutonic standards of beauty, or you see her as all that is good and innocent and sweet about your childhood, but you can't not have a relationship with Barbie.
To me, look, it's a toy.
Joe Blitman is a collectible doll dealer who specializes in Barbie. His Hollywood home is packed with Barbies of every era.
This is the first Barbie. She's wearing the very famous black and white striped swimsuit. Comes with sunglasses, shoes. She came brunette or blonde. And these originally sold for $3.
Today, a doll like this could fetch as much as $12,000. Why would an adult want to pay that kind of money for a Barbie? Most of the customers are women, and they tell Blitman the same thing.
Barbie was their best friend growing up because she always agreed with them. She didn't talk back. She always looked great. And they always envisioned her being 5 to 7 years older than they were, no matter what their age was.
Barbie sprang from the mind of Ruth Handler, whose husband was a co-founder of Mattel. She was watching her daughter Barbara playing with movie star paper dolls when Barbie was born. The first one was based on a German doll named Bild Lilly. She had been inspired by a cartoon character with a fondness for sugar daddies.
They basically copied the face, so it's very hard. I mean, this is not the face of a 17-year-old. This is the face of a 40-year-old woman who's seen a lot of action.
Mattel declined to be interviewed for this story, but Blitman says the company expected controversy from the start.
It was clear to psychologists the doll was going to be a hit with children because it really filled that need of having a role-playing toy, and that parents were destined to absolutely detest it because of the breasts.
And parents did respond so negatively that Sears, the key retailer of the day, initially refused to sell the doll. Mattel soon gave Barbie's face a softer look, but the problem was not the face. If Barbie were human-sized, she would have a relatively modest 36-inch chest, but a waist of only 18 inches. Research at a hospital in Finland said she lacks the body fat required for menstruation. Name another doll who invites that type of scrutiny. Mattel widened Barbie's waist in 1992, and Barbie had a sideways glance until 1971, when her eyes were adjusted to look straight ahead. Blitman believes that was an acknowledgement of the feminist movement, since the direct gaze seems less demure. But tilting her eyes didn't make her into a real girl, says author Peggy Ornstein.
Barbie is a blank.
At one time, Mattel tried to give Barbie a backstory. Her full name is Barbara Millicent Roberts. She's from Willows, Wisconsin, and her parents were George and Margaret. But those details didn't catch on, and Ornstein thinks the fact that Barbie is stubbornly amorphous may explain one of the more common activities that children engage in with Barbie, torturing her.
It's fun. Didn't you do it? It's fun.
Ornstein says a friend told her about a child who lined up her Barbies in the driveway and then had her mother drive over them.
And she was really gleeful about it. I just can't imagine any other toy where you'd, first of all, take the time to do that, where an adult would do it, and where you'd be so happy about it.
Director Todd Haynes, whose films include Far From Heaven and I'm Not There, thinks girls may torture Barbie because they're ambivalent about the feminine ideals that she embodies. Haynes cast Barbie in the role of Karen Carpenter in his 1987 film Superstar, done entirely with dolls.
I mean, Karen, you look really thin.
I like the way I look.
Karen, you starve yourself. All you ever eat is salad and iced tea.
I really don't know why you're making such a big deal out of this.
For Haynes, casting Barbie in the role of an anorexic young woman was an obvious choice.
the use of dolls and the use of Barbie dolls in particular had all of these sort of layers of meaning that I think people really understood without it feeling like an academic exercise.
Over the years, Mattel's tried to make Barbie into a positive role model. She became a pilot instead of a flight attendant, a doctor instead of a nurse. But the really popular Barbies now are princesses, or at least princess-like. Barbie has starred in her own version of Swan Lake and in Rapunzel.
You are herewith invited to the masked ball in honor of the prince's birthday.
It's tonight. Will you come?
I'd love to.
These days, girls play with Barbies when they're very young. By the time they're six, most of them have moved on. Barbie is facing stiff challenges. She's competing with the powerhouse Disney princesses and with toys like Webkinz, which have a big presence on the internet. Orenstein thinks Barbie may be diminished, but she isn't going away for a very simple reason.
If you sort of put aside all the theories and the feminism and the hype and everything, I have to say that, you know, deep in my bones, I still think Barbie's kind of fun.
Compared with the more overtly sexualized dolls in stores today, like the tarted up Bratz, Orenstein says Barbie seems almost quaint. Kim Masters, NPR News.
What great American characters inspire you? Nominate your favorites on our In Character blog. Go to npr.org/incharacter. We may put your suggestion on the radio.
It's easy to add music or delete music from an iPod. Music of the more tangible kind, like CDs or even LPs, can be much tougher to get rid of emotionally as well as physically. Music writer Noel Murray has committed 1 year to listening through his entire album collection, then deciding what to keep and what to toss. He's chronicling his record cleanout in a column for the satirical newspaper, The Onion. Joins us from his home in Conway, Arkansas, near Little Rock. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be here.
Just give us a for instance right now. What's a CD or LP that you recently decided to keep and one to toss?
You know, there are some artists that I've been trying for years to get into because all of my friends like them and because other critics like them, like Cat Power. I've been committing myself for years to liking Cat Power, and I have yet to actually do it. In this series, one of the things I'm doing, actually, is trying to revive the critical reputation of some acts that most of my readers probably would roll their eyes at, bands like Chicago, for example, that have no critical cachet, and yet their first several albums in the early 70s are quite good.
Is there a key that you figured out to what makes a memorable piece of music, something that's for the ages as opposed to just that week?
You know, it's really more what I personally respond to, and I guess part of this project also is trying to figure out, you know, what my taste is. And what I found is that I like songs with a really strong sense of rhythm or polyrhythm. I like it when an artist knows what they're doing and is trying something very purposefully. One of the bands that has been kind of a pleasure to rediscover, you know, at this point I'm going alphabetically and I'm only as far as the late C's, Big Audio Dynamite, you know, the band that came after The Clash with Mick Jones. When their turn came up in the rotation, I listened very carefully to the albums that I had by them. And I discovered that, you know, a lot of what was exciting about The Clash, which is their combining of different musical traditions and putting them out with a personal touch, was equally evident in Big Audio Dynamite.
Speaking of The Clash, and you volunteered that you're only in the late C's, have you gotten to The Clash?
Yes, The Clash was last week.
Don't throw away anything by The Clash.
No. The Clash is actually one of those bands that I listen to the entire discography every year, much like some folks would read a favorite book over and over again.
And anything you've listened to and have just said to yourself, I don't need to listen to that one again.
Well, it's not so much that. It's sort of realizing that I may have liked something because of a certain place in time and I'm just not in that place anymore. Billy Bragg is a good example. I mean, Billy Bragg meant a lot to me when I was in high school and college. And I still think he's got a lot of great music and a lot of great songs. But for me, at least, I would sort of have to be 20 again.
Noel Murray of The Onion speaking to us from his home in Conway, Arkansas. Mr. Murray, nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
This is NPR News.
One other note, this weekend marks the end of the TV series The Wire, HBO plays the final episode on Sunday. Critics and fans grew addicted to a series that chronicled life and death in one American city, Baltimore. It focused on the failure of major civic institutions like police, schools, and the news media. The series co-creator David Simon was formerly a journalist with the Baltimore Sun. He developed the series with a former Baltimore homicide detective. In an iconic scene, Baltimore cops lay a dead officer on a barroom pool table and sing a song from the Pogues, "Body of an American." And so we salute the end of the wire this morning with that song by the Pogues' Shane McGowan.
When we turned and shook, as we had a look in our room where the dead man